Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. Science has become a battleground in recent times, with debates over climate change and technologies like the NBN becoming increasingly important as part of the national dialogue. Today on the show, we have Chief Scientist Ian Chubb, who is collaborating with The Conversation on a joint project to look at Australia in 2025 and how science can address the challenges we face. Ian Chubb, tell us why you embarked on this project. Why is it important?
Michelle, we talk a lot about the issues that confront the country, indeed issues that confront the planet. And we all know, and we talk a lot about the fact that in order to seek solutions to many of these issues and problems, we're going to have to develop interdisciplinary approaches to our work. But the consequence of some of that discussion, I think, has been that we've underplayed the role and the importance of the actual disciplines that you bring to that interdisciplinary project. So it's no point in us pretending that we can do something about Australia's water systems, for example, without having a number of individual disciplines involved in that work. But each of them has to be good, otherwise we're as strong as our weakest link, as it were. So we wanted to focus on the disciplines and explain to people why they're important.
And what audience are you aiming to get to?
So I would like to get to as wide an audience as possible, probably not to the discipline experts themselves, because if they don't know why physics is important, or at least they shouldn't have to read this to find out why it's important. But I'd like to get to the community at large. I'd like to get to young students who are choosing what fields they'd go on to study, from sort of, you know, middle school, middle secondary school, through senior school, through university, and so on. And I'd like to get to politicians, because I think oftentimes when we say, you know, it will be important to understand pandemics or the climate or the water basins of Australia, sure, we can say that, and yes, it is important that we do all those things, but with bad physics, bad maths, poor physics, poor chemistry, poor biology, any or all of those, then our solutions will be poor.
So just tell us how this is going to roll out in terms of the mechanics.
So we've identified 12 disciplines or areas where we've selected 12 authors of 1,200 word essays to explain why their discipline or their area of interest, the area that they work in, not the work that they themselves do, but the area they work in, is important to our future. We have then invited two other people to write a briefer commentary, 200 words, from a slightly different perspective. Some of them are early career researchers. Some of them themselves work in a slightly different part of the field or the discipline. But they're not critiquing the bigger one. They're just giving their comments to try to answer the same question, why the discipline or area is important. And we'll publish those over once a fortnight, I believe it will be, over the next few months to get us to September. In September, we will then have one of those fancy webinar things that The Conversation does well, and we will try to bring together people, primarily to persuade people who tune into the webinar, what we produce, to talk to politicians about why these disciplines are supported and get all of them thinking that we need to support them well.
And the disciplines include? Just
physics, chemistry, mathematics, statistics. Some of the areas include, we've got biology, of course, we've got information communication technology, got agricultural science, which draws off a lot of those disciplines. So we're starting off with physics, chemistry and maths because, in a sense,
the hard ones.
They're the core ones. They're in everything, really. And we've got astronomy, we've got medical science. So there's 12 all in, and we've got some really excellent essays on those
disciplines. Can you tell us some of the authors?
So Peter Doherty's writing one on medical science, Brian Schmidt on astronomy, Terry Speed on statistics, Jeff Prince is doing mathematics, Merlin Crosley has done biology. So it's people who are quite senior in their field, who have got the gravitas that comes with that seniority.
Cast of science.
Yeah, it is. But people who can write in a way that is accessible to people who are not expert.
Is one of the aims of a project like this to try to get more people to take up the disciplines?
Well, it is. And I think it's... In my view, the starting position is a fairly straightforward one, and that is most of the issues that confront us, both as a nation and indeed humanity, will have science somewhere in the way we handle those issues. So it's impossible to consider pandemics without thinking of science being in there. There are social sciences and humanities too, but science will either be very central and substantial or it'll be part of it. And in order to do that properly, we've got to get people to understand the importance of science and the science disciplines as we seek to solve or as we seek to manage or mitigate or adapt to some of the things that confront us. So I'd like science subjects to be so compellingly interesting that every single person wanted to do them. I know that that's a dream that we're never going to achieve, but to get them to be so compellingly interesting that a lot of people want to do them would be really good. They don't have to be scientists. I don't want to live in a world where everybody's a scientist, but I would like them to have some scientific knowledge so that when they're confronted with having to make decisions, that they at least approach those decisions with some understanding of science, how it works, why scientists behave the way they do, why they explain what they do the way they do, all of those little things that would raise the level of community understanding of science.
Now, you're talking about 2025 and how Australia can be prosperous and secure and growing and fitting into a changing world. But is one of the problems that it's quite hard in a time when people are so focused on the now to have them raise their heads and think about 2025? And I'm thinking especially about the politicians, because for them it's a country very far away. They won't be round mostly in politics in 2025, or a lot of them won't.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a test of leadership, isn't it, that you can deal with the now and you can deal with a reasonable period into the future as well. And, I mean, 2025, what does that mean? That means basically that our young people are already in the school system who will be out there in the workforce by 2025. Yeah, that's only 11 years away. So it's I think that part of our leadership role is to position our country well for all of those unpredictabilities that will occur. So this is not about training people for today. It's about educating people for the tomorrow, which allows them to adapt to whatever the circumstances are at the time. And it's a long run. I mean, you know, it is so that if you look at, you know, students who are already well into our education system, completing that education system by 2025, 11 years away, and then deciding what to do as they seek to enter the workforce in the appropriate way, appropriate for them, and their interests, appropriate for where we have available jobs, appropriate for what the country needs them to do, then I think that we've got to start now. And part of my job, I think, is to persuade people that, yes, we can worry about the now, of course we do, but we've also got to worry about what sort of country we're building as we go. And we do that through our education systems and our preparedness to invest in areas where the immediate spin-off might not be so obvious, but the longer-term spin-off is unimaginably important.
Well, of course, at the moment, there's a lot of talk about more money going into the education system, the whole Gonski issue.
do you think that at this time the way science is dealt with in the school system, the proportionate resources going into science needs review?
Well, I'd start in a slightly different place, I suppose, and say that I think that what we need to be much more certain of than we are is how well we prepare and support our teachers. I'm constantly surprised at how a group of people who have so much of the future of this country in their hands are not factored into some of these debates that we're having. So it has been about money, it has been about class sizes, and all of those are important. But the reality is, are we preparing them well enough and are we supporting them well enough in order to make science and the study of science and maths so interesting that more and more young people want to do them? And I don't think we're doing that.
Are the real problems here, and what way are we not supporting them?
Well, I don't think that we pay enough attention to professional development across the country, I'm talking about. The problem with a discussion like this, Michelle, is that somebody can always think of one great gem somewhere that I'm not including in these general comments. But if you look across the country, I don't think we support them well enough with professional development. I don't think we look after them.
You mean keeping up with the field?
Keeping up with the field. I mean, the biology that somebody learnt when they graduated 5 or 6 years ago is different from the way we think about much of biology today. I mean, it took $1 billion to do the human genome a while ago, not all that long ago, and now they can do it virtually overnight for $1,000. I mean, these sorts of things change how you look at a field, change how you regard a field. This morning on the radio, just after you, I think, were on this morning, there was an astronomer from the ANU talking about having discovered the oldest star ever discovered so far, 13 billion years ago. Well, how could you begin to teach that when your students hear about it on the radio and your professional development in physics has been taken you up to 1986 or 1996 or 2005? So I think we've got to invest much more in that, and we've got to look after them much better, and we've got to then build around that an employment group, a group of employers who actually see the value in somebody who comes through an education in science to their workplace, whatever that workplace may be, because you learn critical skills, you learn creative thinking, you learn about evidence, you need to learn about how to challenge evidence and provoke people into producing more evidence. There are all sorts of things intrinsic to that education that are important all over the workplace and not just focused into, oh, you did physics and we don't use physics. I presume they use thinking and they use thinking skills, and these people have got them with knobs on.
What about the media? Do you think that there are too few specialist science writers these days?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think, you know, when I look at the media, there are a lot of people trying to do the right thing, but their expertise or the background knowledge they can bring to it is probably nowhere near it what it used to be when there were specialist science writers who are familiar with the field, familiar with people, can indeed make some judgment calls about how balanced a particular view might be by comparison with other views. So to see things in, say, newspapers where it's wholly dependent on the views of one person is an illustration, I think, of where science journalism is not keeping up with what the public needs to know, and that is, what is the balance of an argument?
What about the new media? Has this helped, or is it not helping particularly?
Well, the professional end of it is helpful, I think. Of course, there are more opinions than you have people on this planet of ours, and they're not all well-founded.
Now, in the political sphere, obviously there was a bit of a kerfuffle when science was dropped as a portfolio name, but do you see science as an issue that should be a matter of political debate, or would you like to see it as an issue where there's a fairly high degree of bipartisanship?
Well, in the ideal world, you'd want bipartisanship. I mean, science is an issue. And science itself is not political. It can be politicised, and we've seen it be politicised over decades, really, in various bits and pieces. But
it's been an issue, for example, on climate change.
Yeah. Well, why should climate change be political? I mean, the evidence is the evidence. The data that have been accumulated, and science works by some people not agreeing with the evidence or the data that's been presented. It's how it progresses. You challenge the data, you challenge the hypothesis, you challenge the argument, and I think that's fine. But that, in fact, has been turned into something much more political. So one side of politics around the world as well, around the world, I suppose I could say, but certainly in some significant countries in the world, it is, one side of politics has embraced one bit of the evidence and another side of politics has embraced the other side of the evidence. And, I'm an old man with a bit of experience, but I can't for the life of me see why that should be the case.
But in fact, it's turned into, of course, one of the hottest, no pun intended, political debates of our time, hasn't it?
Yeah, hot and unedifying.
Now, let's just finish by asking you a very unscientific question. If you had a crystal ball, would you believe that the scientific leaps that will be seen this century will be greater or less or about the same as we saw last century?
Well, I think the thing about science, Michelle, is that the more you know, the more you know what you don't know. And I once remember reading an editorial in a famous science journal, which declared that everything that we could invent or everything we could know was already known or already invented. And
Dear, did they publish it? We were wrong.
Oh yeah, well they should be. They should be doing that every month. I reckon as we're getting better at our deeper knowledge of things, and our technology is keeping pace. I mean, nobody thought a decade ago that you would be able to do a human genome in a couple of days. I don't know exactly how long it is, but 48 hours, let's say. I said earlier one day, but it might be two. And for $1,000, by contrast with the years it took and the billions that it took to do it the first time around, nobody would have thought. So that opens up just things beyond our imagination. They're beyond our imagination, which means we don't know what they are, but they're out there.
So the longer we go, the more we get, really.
Well, I reckon so. And I think what we have to be careful of is that we do it well, so that it's ethical. It's quite consistent with community mores. I don't think we should work outside a sort of, as it were, a social paradigm. But we should apply those talents and skills to finding out more about our natural world and more about our constructed world. And as we discover more, we'll find that there's yet more to discover. So I think the big leaps are still out there ahead of us, just as there were big leaps behind us.
Ian Chubb, a lot of people will be looking forward to those articles. Thank you very much. And thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. See you next time. This is Michelle Grattan.
Thanks, Michelle.